It's time for your KDNK local newscast for this Friday morning. I'm Steve Cole, live from the heart of Carbondale's Creative District. On this week's news brief, we learn that the tension of immigrants in Colorado has nearly doubled this year. News director Gavin Dahl speaks to award-winning reporter Angela Evans from Boulder Weekly about the immigration detention facility in Aurora, Colorado, that's run by the for-profit prison company Geo Group.
Angela Evans is senior editor of Boulder Weekly, one of the West's leading alternative newspapers. Last year, Angela won first place in general reporting in the four-state Rocky Mountain region from the Society of Professional Journalists for a series on immigration. This is the first time I've interviewed Angela, and I'm excited to have you on Community Radio. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Gavin.
You published a piece earlier this month called Immigration Detention in Colorado Nearly Doubles, and I want to learn more about your reporting. Let me start by asking you nationally, do we know how many immigrants are currently being detained in the United States?
We do. According to the Department of Homeland Security, it's about 41,000 currently, up about 10,000 from this time a year ago.
In August, the U.S. Department of Justice directed the Bureau of Prisons to start phasing out the use of private prisons. Talk about the effect of Donald Trump's election victory on the stocks of private prison companies.
So in August, when the Department of Justice directed the Bureau of Prisons to start phasing out private prisons, the two main companies, their stocks plummeted. But the day after Donald Trump was elected, they soared up 18% and 34%, which is a huge jump.
Yeah. The controversial private prison company, the Geo Group, operates Colorado's largest prison for immigrant detainees in Aurora, east of Denver. You wrote that immigration officials didn't respond to your questions regarding the contract between ICE and the Geo Group for that facility. How many people do you believe are being held here in Colorado?
So according to advocate groups that I spoke with, where we used to have about 525 allotted spaces in the Geo facility in Aurora, that's now up to 925 as of October.
So like you said in your headline, nearly doubling the population of detained immigrants. So what do you make of the whole frame that we use in our language that we say detention rather than prison?
Well, it's an interesting choice of words. These are the same companies that operate prisons for criminal detainees, and yet we just call it immigration detention because these people have not been convicted of any crimes. Most of them have no criminal backgrounds. They simply are in the country without proper documentation. And so these facilities are operated exactly the same way as prisons, but the word detention kind of gets the federal government off the hook in saying that, you know, we're not imprisoning them, we're just detaining them.
From a legal standpoint, immigrating without documentation is a civil infraction, not a criminal one, right?
Correct.
So yep. What do the community groups that you've spoken to attribute to the rise of detention numbers? What are they saying is likely causing this influx?
Well, I mean, it's a combination of things. In some ways, I actually would say it is a crackdown by ICE, but that's motivated by some legislation that was introduced first in 2009, but officially became kind of part of policy in 2010, which Congress actually contracts with these private facilities for 34,000 beds a night in immigration detention centers around the country. So that means that our government has agreed to pay for the housing of 34,000 immigrants in detention centers every night. And so whether or not they're actually being used, our tax dollars are still paying for those beds. Therefore, ICE has begun to put more people into detention, you know, in order to be fulfilling that bed quota. It's what activists call the bed quota of 34,000 beds a night.
And so one of the groups you spoke with is the Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network. What were they saying about Haitians?
The Department of Homeland Security released a statement saying that they would resume regular removals of Haitians. There's been an influx of Haitians coming to the United States, mostly through the southern border between Mexico and California, mostly after the earthquake in 2010. And as you know, the infrastructure and basic necessities and services have greatly declined in the country. And so what the Remain said, the Rocky Mountain Immigration Advocacy Network, has said is that, you know, where there used to be maybe a couple dozen or so of Haitians detained at the Geo facility in Aurora, now there's about 300 to 400. Most of them, in general, are asylum seekers. However, this is where immigration law is probably one of the most complicated legal systems that we have. I've heard many activists and immigration lawyers refer to it as, you know, more complicated than our tax code. So they are asylum seekers, but because they cross the border and then claim asylum, they're actually what's known as defensive asylum seekers versus offensive. If they came here first with a visa and then tried to apply for asylum, that's treated a little bit differently. So because they entered the country without proper documentation and then claimed asylum, that's where they get sent to detention.
Wow. It's just, you know, our most vulnerable neighbors being treated like criminals. But another aspect of your reporting is what's happening at the federal level with Department of Homeland Security, as Secretary Jay Johnson will likely be out of office very soon. Can you explain?
A lot of it is just speculation based on, you know, what President-elect Donald Trump said in his campaign, what some of his advisors and campaign staff are saying now. There's not really a clear direction on what's going to be happening when it comes to immigration detention and deportations. However, currently, the Department of Homeland Security, and in particular Secretary Johnson, is looking at the private immigration detention to see if there's any ways to improve conditions, to maybe start phasing out the use of private facilities in immigration detention. It's just, with such little time left in office, it's unclear whether or not he will be able to make any decisions that will last through the next presidency. I guess the one thing that I find most striking about this story is, you know, these are private companies running these detention facilities. So they are publicly traded companies making a profit off of housing immigrants in this way, in prison-like conditions. You know, in the August report by the Department of Justice that asked the Bureau of Prisons to begin phasing out the use of these facilities, there was major safety and security concerns within these facilities. And so these are companies that, although Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement does have oversight over, they're also private corporations. And so there's a little bit of a lack of oversight, of a difficulty in being able to get information from what's really going on in the facilities. And all the while, these companies are profiting off of these practices and policies by our federal government.
Have you had trouble getting more than just talking points from anyone in the ICE side of this?
I have, actually. I rarely get to speak to anybody on the phone. When I do, I'm usually asked for email questions, to which I get prefabricated statement response that often don't actually address the questions I'm asking. A large percentage of the time they do respond. However, I would say it's very limited that they actually answer the questions I'm asking in regards to this. Same for the GEO Group and the private prison industry. It's very difficult to get more than written statements that broad brush the topic rather than address the actual questions I'm asking.
Angela Evans is senior editor at Boulder Weekly, an award-winning reporter who has done a lot of work on immigration. Her latest piece on the subject is called Immigration Detention in Colorado Nearly Doubles. Really interesting to hear more about your work, Angela. Thanks for speaking to KD&K.
Thank you.
And we will link to Angela's latest piece on immigration, as well as the series that won her an award from the Society of Professional Journalists last year, on our website at kdnk.org. Several updates from Garfield County this week. The program through public health called the Garfield Healthy Communities Coalition, formerly known as LiveWell, has received a $500,000 grant from the nonprofit Colorado Health Foundation to be used over the next 3 years. GARCO has updated its road impact fees for the first time in 20 years. Fees are assessed on building permits for new developments based on the square footage of the project. The money is used primarily for improvements to roads in order to accommodate new developments. The Rifle Garfield County Airport will receive nearly $9 million in upgrades thanks to an investment from the airport's fixed base operator Atlantic Aviation, a private partner of the county. Atlantic recently completed a new 30,000-square-foot heated hangar, including office space, a new lobby, and a pilot's lounge. The county itself invested nearly $4 million at the airport this year, including a new airport entrance to augment the expansion by Atlantic. When families and friends get together during the holiday season, the presidential election could come up, causing tension between folks who usually get along. But as Eric Galatis reports, there are ways to keep the conversation civil.
"We respectfully agree to disagree" may be the mantra heard at many office parties and holiday gatherings across the country. Emotions are still charged for a lot of people after the presidential election. Pari Saparsa of Essential Partners says everyone needs to ask themselves if they're grounded enough to resist angry outbursts and frustration, and if they can listen and speak with care so they don't damage important relationships. She says avoiding political conversations for now might be a good idea if people are feeling tense, but eventually everyone should be able to talk about it.
Long term, it does our democracy, our families, and ourselves a big disservice not to go to the tough stuff, because those deeply held values and positions come out of our personal experience.
Tips to avoid a big conflict include recognizing the signs of polarization, agitation, and strong emotion before they get out of control, practicing ways of speaking, listening, and asking questions that foster sincere curiosity, and avoiding the pattern of attack and defend. Joan Blades with Living Room Conversation says no one should completely avoid talking with those who have differing opinions, because debate is very beneficial.
When we fail to talk to people with different viewpoints, and just talk to people that think like us, we actually make our own viewpoints more extreme. That's a disaster for having a successful democracy.
Parsha says arguing about viewpoints doesn't usually change anyone's mind, and more information about a topic doesn't persuade anyone, since both sides usually have their own sets of facts to support their arguments. She says you can't have a full relationship with someone unless you can talk things out.
When we reduce someone to their political positions, we're not able to see them fully, and we're losing out on the opportunity to relate around other things that are common concerns. So when we're seeing each other in stereotypes, we're putting ourselves in a box as well.
For KDNK, I'm Eric Galatis.
When families and friends get together during the holiday season, the presidential election could come up, causing tension between folks who usually get along. But as Eric Galatis reports, there are ways to keep the conversation civil.
"We respectfully agree to disagree" may be the mantra heard at many office parties and holiday gatherings across the country. Emotions are still charged for a lot of people after the presidential election. Pari Saparsa of Essential Partners says everyone needs to ask themselves if they're grounded enough to resist angry outbursts and frustration, and if they can listen and speak with care so they don't damage important relationships. She says avoiding political conversations for now might be a good idea if people are feeling tense, but eventually everyone should be able to talk about it.
Long term, it does our democracy, our families, and ourselves a big disservice not to go to the tough stuff, because those deeply held values and positions come out of our personal experience.
Tips to avoid a big conflict include recognizing the signs of polarization, agitation, and strong emotion before they get out of control, practicing ways of speaking, listening, and asking questions that foster sincere curiosity, and avoiding the pattern of attack and defend. Joan Blades with Living Room Conversation says no one should completely avoid talking with those who have differing opinions, because debate is very beneficial.
When we fail to talk to people with different viewpoints, and just talk to people that think like us, we actually make our own viewpoints more extreme. That's a disaster for having a successful democracy.
Parsha says arguing about viewpoints doesn't usually change anyone's mind, and more information about a topic doesn't persuade anyone, since both sides usually have their own sets of facts to support their arguments. She says you can't have a full relationship with someone unless you can talk things out.
When we reduce someone to their political positions, we're not able to see them fully, and we're losing out on the opportunity to relate around other things that are common concerns. So when we're seeing each other in stereotypes, we're putting ourselves in a box as well.
For KDNK, I'm Eric Galatis.